Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
When you think about it, what stitches the events of the last 3 months together is breath. One could make that argument anyway, right? I mean, we've got this virus that attacks the respiratory system, collects on mucosal tissues, does weird things to respiration so that blood oxygen levels fall, sometimes without patients even having typical shortness of breath symptoms. Okay, so that's one over there. To say nothing of the fact that there's like a black market in pulse oximeters right now. But anyway, that's over there. Then over here, we have the recent period of racial troubles that were triggered, in fact, by a man saying, "I can't breathe," not the first man. We have a debate over chokeholds that do cut off the breath and that do result in fatalities. So, yes, to the extent that one crisis has compounded another crisis, you could argue that breath is the common denominator. And that, in fact, is what we're going to talk about today. Towards the end of the show, we will talk very specifically about breath and these issues with commentator Dahlia Lithwick. But right now, we're going to talk about breath itself. First of all, I always think that if there are extraterrestrials watching us, they are amazed that we're the dominant species on our planet. I mean, I feel like they're up there in their ship going, wow, they don't eat right. They don't drink enough water. Most of them don't get enough exercise. And it turns out also they don't really breathe correctly. I mean, you know, for the form of the carbon-based form that they are, it's like they don't get what they have to do. And I've learned so much about breathing from this book by our guest, James Nestor. His book is Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. And he joins us today. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, yes, I mean, even though the extraterrestrials are up there disparaging us, it could be argued, and you do argue, that the breath thing, we're doing it wrong, but it's not entirely our fault. It's actually a product of the same evolutionary process that resulted in the increased brain capacity that allowed us, in other ways, to become a dominant species. So what was happening to the structural aspects of our breathing apparatus while that was happening?
Well, that was certainly a part of it. So about 1.5 million years ago, we started processing food. And by that, we started smashing prey against rocks to make it easier to chew. And so all that extra energy that we saved from chewing allowed us to grow a larger brain. And around 800,000 years ago, we started cooking things in fire, released more energy, less chewing. And so we adopted to all of these changes, these morphological changes in our faces, just fine. Our faces grew flatter, our mouths grew smaller, our sinuses grew smaller. But until around 500 years ago, when the food got so processed, so soft, that's when things started really changing for the worse and impacting our ability to breathe properly.
Now, explain again why that would be the case. What would be the connection between chewing and breathing?
So a lot of people have associated the problems with industrialized, highly processed food with lack of vitamins and minerals. And that's certainly true to a certain extent. But most of the problems tied to the mouth and our ability to grow a mouth that's the proper size for our face comes down to chewing, because we need that stress. We've evolved to need the stress to build the right bones, to build the right muscles and ligaments and everything else to be able to grow a mouth that is of the proper size. And what I mean by that is that if you think about yourself or most people around you, there's a good chance about 90% of them are going to have crooked teeth, or they had crooked teeth before they had braces. So that's not normal at all. The reason why so many humans now have crooked teeth is because our mouths are too small. So teeth have nowhere to go in but crooked. The other problem with that is that a mouth that's too small also has a smaller airway. And this is one of the reasons so many of us snore, sleep apnea, and have other respiratory problems because of that shrinking mouth.
The whole explanation of this in the book, which we can't even do justice to is fascinating. Although I have to say, as somebody whose DNA tests fairly high for Neanderthal content, I did not appreciate the phrase big-nosed Neanderthals.
You know, that was meant as a compliment, because to have a big, powerful nose, as I get into in the book, is the first line of defense to protect us against pathogens, to allow us to breathe more properly. So that, our Neanderthal brethren, I only talk in the highest regard for them.
Well, you say that. You took our land, man. We want Europe back.
They're coming back, you know, give it 200 years.
That's right. Particularly if we keep breathing in this the way that we're breathing right now. So the central argument of your book is that, A, the way that we breathe currently, the sort of natural habit that we fall into, is deleterious to our health on multiple fronts. And that for thousands of years, there has been science and research and wisdom about all this, most of which somehow or other hasn't become canonical, hasn't really at least become part of the Western medical canon. But maybe you want to amplify that statement a little bit.
Sure. And I'm a journalist, right? I went into this world with a completely objective view. It doesn't matter to me if, you know, mouths have grown smaller because of one reason or the other. But I talk to the experts in this field. And if you were to look, it's so obvious. Once you learn this stuff, you're like, well, of course, this is what happens. Because look at any ancient skull, any skull older than about 500 years old, down to 5,000 years old, 50,000 years, 500,000 years old, all of your Neanderthal brethren, and they're going to have, there's a very good chance they're going to have perfectly straight teeth. These people didn't have dentists. They didn't have Invisalign. They didn't have their wisdom teeth removed, and yet they had straight teeth. And by having those straight teeth, by that regard, they had these huge jaws. And by having these huge jaws, they had larger nasal apertures. So this sounds like some fringy theory, but it's really not. It's so clearly documented in the skeletal record.
So we're going to go deeper into this, but I would be remiss if we didn't just pause and say, you wrote this book, obviously, before the outbreak of COVID-19. It must be so odd doing interviews like this one in support of this book at a time when, yeah, I mean, for example, pulse oximeters play a recurring role in your book, in some of the scenes in your book, the whole sense of breath and blood oxygen levels and stuff like that, much of which is at the heart of the symptomatic presentation of COVID-19. And maybe a little bit more pertinently, you know, in these high-tech hospital environments, one of the first things they figured out that worked wasn't some kind of elaborate pharma invention or a piece of tech. It was really kind of an old thing called proning. I'm guessing that didn't surprise you.
Well, I remember when I first started this book about 3.5-4 years ago. That's how long it's taken me to get this thing together. I was telling my friends, my other author friends, journalists, I said, I'm going to write this book on breath, on breathing. And they all mocked me. they said, you know, I've been breathing my whole life. I don't need to be told how to breathe or how I'm breathing incorrectly. And now that the tide has really turned. And what's been so gratifying for me is, you know, I went out and talked to so many experts who had been doing this research for 20, 30, even 40 years, studying this stuff. No one had really been listening. And if there's one good thing to come out of this foul, foul epidemic, it's that people are really starting to pay attention to their breathing. And proning is just a perfect example. So 2,000 years ago, Chinese doctors were telling people to always sleep on their sides. And about 80 years ago, a Russian cardiologist told his patients with pneumonia, said, always sleep on your side. He would tape a tennis ball or a ball on their back so they couldn't sleep on their back. And so it's fascinating to see just 3 weeks ago, you know, we discovered, hey, it makes sense for us to breathe on our sides or breathe on our stomachs, considering that when we take a breath in, most of that inflation from our lungs is in our back. It's not in our chest. So just seeing that one little tweak and the huge benefits from it, this is no new science. You know, this stuff has been around for a long time. It's just people are starting to look to the past, what's worked in the past to help us get through this thing in the future.
So There's so much to ask here. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that's in your book is now might have seemed a little bit odd or off the beaten path at the time, but it's kind of just part of the fabric of life now. I mean, even there's sort of a hardcore nasal swab scene at the beginning of the book, you know, and people complain about the nasal swab tests for the PCR test for COVID-19. Yours involved actually going in there with, well, you said it was like kind of a little wire brush going deep into your nose. We should say you did a lot of stuff. This is one of these books where you put yourself through some of the research that you're writing about.
Well, I wanted to understand the subject from the inside. And with some of these tests, no one else would really do them. That test in particular, I was talking to the chief of rhinology research at Stanford, this guy named Dr. Jayakar Nayak, who's fascinated with the nose and all the benefits of nasal breathing. And he knew, it's clearly defined, how bad mouth breathing is for the body, for immune system, for sleep, for everything. And I asked him, I said, well, how soon does that damage come on? And he had no idea because nobody had tested it. So we cooked up this experiment in which for 10 days, I tested it with me and one other person. To plug our noses and just breathe through our mouths. And the intention of this wasn't to do like this supersize me stunt, you know. It was to lull ourselves into a position that 25 to 50% of the population already understands because they habitually mouth breathe and to really see what was happening. And so that's what we did. 10 days, nose plugged. It was awful. And that test you're referring to. So imagine that COVID test, but imagine that brush being wire. And imagine that being in your nose about 3 or 4 inches. Truly awful. But in the name of science, you know, we went forward and did it. So 10 days mouth breathing, 10 days nasal breathing. Then we compared the data sets.
So yeah, what's worth mentioning is towards the end of the book, you kind of get your grades back, but you and the guy you're doing it with, Anders Olsen, you kind of already know what you're going to see more or less. But it is really pretty startling that so many indices of ill health are ratcheted up when your nose is plugged and your mouth is open and brought back down when your mouth is plugged and your nose is open. But maybe mention a few of those because they're all the things that many of us are taking medications for right now as opposed to learning to breathe.
Well, things like blood pressure, that had been pretty well documented. Mouth breathing, you're breathing too much, your blood pressure is going to go up. So, you know, my blood pressure went up about 15 points, 20 points. And so we expected those things to happen. We weren't looking forward to those things happening, but they happened. But what we did not expect at all was that both of us had gone from not snoring at all, about 3 minutes a night, to snoring about 4 hours a night within 3 or 4 days of this experiment. We both got sleep apnea. We were fatigued the whole time. And so I don't think a lot of people who are snoring and have sleep apnea, especially mild to moderate sleep apnea and snoring, I don't think they're really realizing how much of the ways in which they inhale and exhale that air plays into those conditions. And we found that the day that we started nasal breathing at night instead of mouth breathing, snoring, sleep apnea totally went away. Within 3 or 4 days, we had zero snoring, zero sleep apnea. So it to me, that was fascinating. This was something nobody expected. And I hope to get, you know, and Stanford's hoping to get the word out about this as well, how important nasal breathing is just to be able to breathe at night.
But there's so much more in the book, and a lot of it is, once again, sort of kind of non-canonical stuff, often conducted by people who aren't at prestigious research institutions, and often with really, really interesting results. There's a character named Carl Stowe. I don't know if I'm saying that last name correctly, but since a lot of his research happened not too far from where I'm sitting right now, here in Connecticut, both at the West Haven VA Hospital and then at Yale. Maybe you could just mention a little bit about what this guy found, and it sort of starts with emphysema. Emphysema is kind of notoriously incurable, but that doesn't mean you can't find more breathing capacity for somebody with emphysema.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about these outlier researchers, right? They're coming from such a different place than people who have been traditionally medically trained that they're able to look at things differently. And Stowe was a vocal teacher. He was a choral conductor, and he taught his singers how to sing better and started winning all of these competitions, started training the opera singers at Met Opera in New York. And then he was called in after doing this for years and years to help emphysemics at the VA hospitals. And just as you had said, these people had essentially been left for dead, you know, pumped up with antibiotics, given an oxygen tank, and just sort of left in the hospital because no one knew how to cure them or how to help them. So he went in and developed this breathing technique basically to build their diaphragmatic movement, to build that muscle organ up a little more. And he was told repeatedly that doing that is impossible. You cannot build movement in the diaphragm. Totally impossible. Well, they took x-rays, they took films, and not impossible, totally possible. So what happens with emphysema is once that lung tissue is damaged, you can't get it back. But that doesn't mean you can't access more of the lungs. And that's what he did for these patients, allowed them to access more of their lungs. And what was so interesting about him as well is that everything that he was doing was documented. There's data, and there were other scientists backing him up the whole way. But when he left the hospital system after doing this for 10 years, helping thousands and thousands of patients, his therapy was completely ignored. And you know, his book, he wrote one self-published, or not self-published, wrote one book in 1970, and now it's like $400 on Amazon. So it's really hidden far away, but nobody disproved what he was doing. They never denied that the therapy worked. It just sort of disappeared. And I kept finding these stories over and over and over again.
Right. We should mention he went from the emphysemics to coaching really elite athletes. I mean, first the Yale track team, but then Olympic athletes, and was able to very, very quickly, dramatically improve their performance, you know, with things as simple as the notion of exhaling. So this book, which is about breath, it is also, I think, very much a book about, it's like a Thomas Kuhn reaffirmation that, you know, instead of scientific revolutions happening on the basis of the introduction of new evidence, orthodoxy kind of chases orthodoxy. You know, there's a way in which things that just don't really fit the pattern of medical or scientific understanding at a moment get overlooked. So yeah, you have another person who uses breath as a way of dealing with scoliosis, which in some ways is an even harder thing to sort of wrap your mind around.
Yeah, she was a teenager living in Dresden, Germany. Her name is Katharina Schroth, and she had scoliosis and was, you know, given a wheelchair and a cane and told to live her life. But she had different views about the human body's potential and developed this thing called orthopedic breathing, where she would breathe into one lung and stretch, and breathe into the other lung and stretch. And she did this for years until she breathed her spine straight again. And that sounds completely impossible until you see the pictures. And she went on and taught thousands and thousands of other women how to do this. It was extremely successful. Once again, medical authorities in Germany came in and said, you are not qualified to teach anyone. They tried to shut her down. And at the end of her life, you know, she lived to be 91. At the end of her life, the German government awarded her the highest prize for her contributions to medicine. So you just see these waves of denial and acceptance. And it takes sometimes 20, 30 years for the authorities and the institutions to come around. And for each of these people, you know, I didn't just rely on their words. I talked to experts in the field. I looked at the x-rays, and all of this stuff checks out. And they're currently using Schroth's methods at Johns Hopkins right now. You know, it's very intensive. Maybe a lot of people don't want to do it, but it works. And it just shows you the power of just breathing differently can change the physical structure of your body.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. We're talking to James Nestor, and we're going to keep talking to him. In fact, when we come back from the break, we're going to tell you things that absolutely could change and possibly save your life. And the main reason I'm saying that is because there's going to be a little pledge break in here, and so I don't want you to go away. But I'm also not entirely kidding either. So, and one thing I want to say about the pledge break, this is sort of our end of the year balance, the budget stuff. And we've just had a wave of bloodletting all over the landscape of public radio. The economics of 2020 caught up with a lot of companies and stations within public radio. And there's some shows that you really like that we won't have anymore because they've been canceled. But for that reason, I mean, we're in better shape than a lot of stations, but it's important, and it's been kind of a little bit slow. I mean, everybody doesn't feel flush right now. So when these nice people come on, please listen to them and please consider pledging. It really does matter, especially right now. And then it's a very short little pledge break. Don't go away. We're going to come back with James Nestor telling you more about breathing after this.
Between two lungs, it was released. The breath that passed from you. That's right. So you can go to WMPR.org/donate, or you can call 1-800-584-2788 to donate to Connecticut Public today. I'm Kat Pastor. I'm the board op for the Colin McEnroe Show, as well as a few other shows here at Connecticut Public. And I'm with Frankie Graziano, who is one of the most beloved reporters at Connecticut Public, from what I've seen. And we are here today to ask for your pledge of support, because as most listeners know, we are a listener-supported station. And throughout the pandemic, I think across every platform we have, we've been doing nothing but expanding the way that expanding the number of shows, expanding the way that we get content out to our listeners, and even revamping quite a few shows. And we couldn't do that without your support. So again, 1-800-584-2788 if you feel like talking to a person, or you can go to WMPR.org/donate, which is a really easy way to make a pledge. You can either become a monthly sustaining member, which means that you would get a certain amount of money taken out of your bank account every month. It's set it and forget it, and you can change the amount at any time, or you can be a one-time donor. And also on the website, you can see all the great thank you gifts that we have for those who pledge. We still have some old favorites, like the Connecticut Public Radio pint glass for $5 a month, or the Connecticut Public Radio wireless earbuds for $15. But also this month, for $12.50 per month, we are offering a spring bouquet in honor of Mother's Day. So, you know, if you're searching for a nice gift for your mom for Mother's Day, or your wife, then, you know, I definitely encourage that. So, again, 1-800-584-2788 or WMPR.org/donate. What's up, Frankie?
1-800-584-2788 is the number. You get to hear the great Colin McEnroe when you listen to this program and listen to us pledge. But not only that, you talked about expansion. We've had some great programming added in terms of Audacious with Kyone Wolf, who talks to some people, giving maybe the most exhilarating kind of accounts of things that have happened to them. They certainly live by the tenor of that show. And Kalila Brown-Dean's Disrupted is just such a fantastic conversation on race, not just local issues and what's happening here locally with police reform, efforts to use maybe marijuana legislation to actually help people that live in cities and people that are living in underserved communities, but also national issues like what we're seeing in this trial of Derek Chauvin and how we're now really confronting race and how things have happened in this country for so many years. That's what you do when you support Connecticut Public Radio. You allow us to have this kind of star power in our network with a Kalila Brown-Dean, a Kyone Wolf, and a Colin McEnroe. It also allows us to have new shows. It also allows us to bring on great new talent to tell stories on a daily basis. I work in the newsroom to tell some breaking news. It also helps us bring in somebody like a Kat Pastor, who's more than just a board op. We talk about what we're doing during a pandemic. It is really tough to deliver this content to you. I'm sitting under a blanket in my basement in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Easy enough for me to record this. Kat's got to then mix this down. Her and Gene got to work on this. Gene Amatruda, they have been the absolute goats of this pandemic to make sure that we can still raise money. And raising money is important because it allows us to get closer to where you are, folks out there. So if you really support what we do, go to WNPR.org and click donate, or you can call 1-800-584-2788.
That's right. And, you know, everything that we all do is in service to the listener. I know that Colin McEnroe of the show that you're listening to right now, always says that he doesn't want to put something on the air just to put something on the air. Everything you're hearing is so well thought out, so thoroughly researched, and has so much time and effort put into it that it's like crazy. And it doesn't matter the topic, whether it be something serious to socks, they will put the time and effort into it and make it worth your time. So hopefully that you do think that it's worth it and you show your pledge of support today to keep our station running and ever expanding, as we mentioned earlier. So again, there's a couple ways that you can do that. If you're down for talking on the phone, you're a phone person, 1-800-584-2788. And again, if you don't feel like really interacting with anyone today, I know like sometimes you get a little pandemic fatigue and forget how to talk to people, WMPR.org/donate. We thank you so much for your support. Now back to Colin.
All right. And we are back. We are pleased to be back with this show based on this really fascinating book, Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art by James Nestor. He, the author, is with us right now. We'll also be talking to old friend Dahlia Lithwick in a little while, also about the role breath has played in the national narrative right now. You know, I mean, we've talked a little bit about some of these outliers, outlier researchers, outlier discoverers of techniques that exist kind of side by side with the mostly Western medical canon. But James Nestor, another part of your book is about older traditions that precede the Western medical canon and most other stuff as well. Anybody who's taken a lot of yoga or even a little yoga probably knows that. And I should say that I took for about 5 years, I was very, very, very intensively into yoga. And it's not unusual for the teacher to say, you know, yoga is basically breath. And the other stuff is just stuff we're getting you to do. We get you to breathe. And this is something that you found, right? That over and over again, there has been, over the course of thousands of years, a lot of writing about the connection between breath and well-being.
And you can look at almost any major culture for the last few thousand years. You know, it arguably started with in the Indus Valley 5,000 years ago, this understanding of breath being this medicine or this tool. Then it popped up in China about 2,000 years ago. Then the ancient Greeks, you know, got into it. And on and on and on. What I found was fascinating. Once you placed all these pieces together and connected the dots, they were all discovering the same exact thing. And I don't think many of them had contact with one another, but they all came to the same conclusions about breathing. And, you know, they didn't have pulse oximeters back then. They weren't able to test exactly what was happening in their bodies and their blood gases. But, you know, they had empirical studies. They were able to form their own technology by seeing what was benefiting people and what wasn't. And the fact that they all came to these same techniques, I thought was fascinating. And now to see these techniques being studied in labs with all of this wonderful technology that we have and seeing the profound benefits these breathing techniques have, I think is just adds credence to so much of what they had been saying for so long.
We won't have time to go through all of this, but one of the more fascinating traditions that you stepped into, and I may be pronouncing it wrong, is Tummo, something that's mm-hmm. both ancient and also in a lot of modern use, including by the Navy SEALs, who we don't necessarily associate with enlightened breathing practices. But so tell us about Tummo.
So about 1,000 years ago, this was documented, this breathing technique that allowed monks to stay warm during the winter time. They could only wear like a thin sheet on and heat themselves through breathing, which of course sounds completely fallacious. And this lady, Alexander David Neal, Parisian, went out to Tibet and discovered this and wrote about it in this amazing book called My Journeys to Lhasa, about her 14 years, and no one really believed it then. So as more people went to India and went to Tibet and started seeing monks doing this, part of their initiation was they would have to sit outside in the snow overnight and breathe in a way that would melt a circle around them. Then they would come back in the morning. Impossible, right? So Herbert Benson, who was a Harvard researcher, had heard enough of these stories. He said, okay, I'm going to go test this out. So he went to India, hooked up these monks to every imaginable sensor and had them breathe in this way and witnessed an absolute transformation in their bodies. They were able to dry wet sheets on their back in a cold room within about a half an hour. They were able to heat up the extremities in their fingers, their toes by about 17 degrees, and they were able to slow their metabolic rates by about 65%. So, I mean, this is, according to what we know about medical science, totally impossible. And yet there's the data, there's the videotape. So now Wim Hof, which some of the listeners may have heard of, has taken this Tummo breathing and really exploded it and shown hundreds of thousands of people to do it. And now they're recording that what a significant benefit it has, especially for people with autoimmune problems and autonomic nervous system issues, how it can rebalance them and help them really recover. And what's fascinating to me is, you know, they're studying this at Stanford, they're studying it at top universities, and there's real data behind it. It's not just hearsay or anecdotal.
You know, I do think, maybe this is a tiny bit off the track, but I don't think so. So there's obviously, you know, in the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a yoga revolution in America. But, you know, Americans tend to treat yoga as a kind of fitness. And I myself will plead guilty during my years to thinking, oh, when is all this pranayama stuff going to be over so we can really, you know, start doing something? And I think for a lot of people in these classes, you know, they're there to stretch and build muscle tone and stuff like that. And so the breathing stuff, particularly the alternating nostril stuff, which you really get into in the book and which I used to regard as incredibly boring and waiting for it to be over, it is, I think, possible that there are a lot of people doing yoga and giving kind of, you should pardon the expression, lip service to breath without really embracing the kinds of stuff that you're talking about.
So the yoga we know now, that we practice now, the vinyasa flow, all these movements, that's about 100 years old. Okay. So before 100 years ago, there were not these flows, these flow movements. And we know these flow movements, these have massive benefits. You're going to look good. You're going to get healthier. Totally. But the benefits are very similar to other exercise. So the first yoga was about sitting down and focusing on your breath. And then as it evolved about 2000 years ago, you would pose, hold these poses for minutes at a time and breathe. So the entire anchor to this was to stretch your bodies in ways so that you could breathe in different ways and fall into that meditative state. So I'm convinced that the vast majority of benefits from meditation, especially at the beginning, are from breathing. You don't need to, you know, recite your mantra. You can do that. That's great. But the benefits of slowing down and focusing on your breath while thinking about whatever you want to think about are profound. And that's been well studied as well.
So, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about right now are things that you personally have done. As I said before, I mean, this book begins with you. You're fortunate enough to live in San Francisco or were at the time, so you could go to a breathing class, which is not necessarily available everywhere. And that kind of woke you up in a certain way. You, I think, are still doing kind of an online Tumo thing on Monday nights or something. I mean, I don't know. How much have you personally changed by all this? How changed do you feel, or can you demonstrate that you are?
Well, as a science journalist, you know, you just want to go in and talk to the experts and try to stay out of the story as much as you possibly can, so the facts are completely straight and objective. But after spending 3 years in this community, talking to these experts, these scientists, visiting these labs, you get kind of emotionally invested in this. You see the benefits of an asthmatic who's had asthma for 50 years, changed her breathing, now has no symptoms of asthma, and that's been measured. Someone who's lowered his CRPs by 40-fold within a few weeks by changing his breathing. You figure I would be a fool not to adopt some of these techniques in my own lifestyle. And what I tried to do with a lot of these in these labs and in these studies was to be able to see the effects of breathing in different ways in my own body and then compare that to what's actually happening in the science. So it's not just anecdotes. You're looking at the science as a whole. But I want to experience this stuff. So it makes you a bit of a neurotic, you know, after 3 years of learning about how unhealthy mouth breathing is and how healthy other forms of breathing, nasal breathing is. But at the same time, it's just more tools in the toolkit. I look at breathing as these different levers. You know, we're not able to control our liver function or stomach function or our bowels, but we can control the way in which we breathe. When we control the way in which we breathe, we can influence all of those functions down to the, you know, subatomic level of what's happening in our cells. And that to me is fascinating. This is something we do 25,000 times a day. And if you think that you can just get by, you know, doing it incorrectly, you know, your body can compensate in a lot of ways, but why do that? You want to allow your breaths to be as easy and as enriching as possible, and your body will really benefit from that.
All right, we're going to have to stop there. And a lot of times with interviews like this, you'll hear the host say, but you really have to read the whole book. And a lot of times we do that just out of a courtesy to the author, because we don't want people to feel like now they don't have to read the book because they heard the interview. It really is the case with this book. You have to read the whole book. You're not going to get so much of what you really want to and need to understand if this subject intrigues you. So the book is Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art by James Nestor. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with an old friend with a new subject, Dahlia Lithwick. All right, so we are back, and it is time for me to say some thank yous. Those thank yous go to Kat Pastor, who's there in the studio, making it possible for me to work remotely, and for the producer, executive producer, senior producer, Betsy Kaplan, who is the producer of this episode. So thanks to Kat. Thanks to Betsy for putting this thing together here. And thanks to you also if you're supporting Pledge Drive, just to see if we can sort of balance the books, as they say. So thanks to you if you're supporting that too. All right, Dahlia Lithwick has been on our show many, many times. I'm senior editor for Slate. We would have been trying to book her anyway today, like everybody else is, because of the DACA decision, which we're probably going to have to quickly talk about. It would be crazy to have Dahlia Lithwick on and not talk about the Dahlia about the DACA decision. See, the Dahlias and the DACAs, they can get all mixed up in your head very easily. But we're also talking to her about a piece titled "America Gasps for Air" in Slate. And Dahlia, I mean, in a way, we can add DACA to this pretty easily, right? There's a way in which you're using this idea of breath, whether it's the damage that COVID-19 does or the damage a chokehold does, to a kind of airlessness and lack of oxygenated nourishment that you see running through the American narrative right now.
I think that's right, Colin. And weirdly, as DACA was coming down and I was reading the opinion this morning and sort of anticipating this conversation about breath, I thought this is a funny ultimate conclusion, because while those 700,000 dreamers who are not going to be deported, at least not now, based on this 5-4 decision, can certainly take in a breath and realize they're here. The court also left them hanging and said, but if the Trump administration tries and properly rescinds DACA, we might be able to do this. And so there's a weird way in which breathing also feels like it runs through this decision, where you can't actually breathe out and say we're safe. You just have to wait and hope the next administration doesn't do it right.
Right. I mean, we could force this this metaphor even more and say that, well, first of all, we do spend a lot of time hoping that Ruth Bader Ginsburg keeps breathing. A lot of us are holding our breath. We're holding our breaths about this decision. People who wanted Elizabeth Warren are being told to hold their noses and vote for Biden. I mean, there's sort of a lot of this stuff that we go through. But let's sort of back up and say that there is a way in which the two major crises of 2020, COVID-19 and the George Floyd murder and everything that's piled on top of that, they have breath at the center of them in a very odd way. And maybe we can start with George Floyd, because, you know, even, I don't know, I went back and reading the transcript even of his last words, there's something very primal about the fact that he can't breathe. And he's saying he can't breathe. And at a certain point, he knows he's in all probability dying. I don't know. There's something just so inarguably horrible about that.
Yeah, I at the end of the piece about breath, I put his last words almost in a poem form, just because I felt that in and of itself, those words, over and over again, I cannot breathe, I cannot breathe, they're going to kill me, I can't breathe. It felt like it, I mean, beyond just the atrocity of the murder itself, it felt like it was directly mapping onto something deep that everybody is feeling, not just when the police are kneeling on your neck, but as you said, through this pandemic, wearing these masks, cities on fire. It really resonated way beyond just the absolute horror of his own death.
Right. And so, I mean, as we switch over to COVID, yeah, I mean, even now we are about to have a weekend here in Connecticut. I don't even really want to mention this, because the people who are doing it are doing this incredibly dangerous thing for very immature reasons. But there are people who want to have like, I'm not wearing a mask day. But there is a way in which, and what's especially insane about this is that these are the same people who were demonstrating, honking their horns during the shutdown because of its effect on their small businesses. Now they want to do something that may cause another shutdown. But there's a way in which you at least sort of get the idea that they don't like the mask, partly because they feel stifled by the mask. And as you were just suggesting, that's, you know, that is another part of the story of this year.
Yeah, it's, I think for me, I read yesterday, and I can't remember where it's happening, that folks are actually planning to burn their masks en masse in some kind of political statement. And I thought it's such a right doubling down. Not only are you refusing to wear your mask, but you're actually going to fill the sky with smoke from burning masks. And there is a sense in which, and I guess this is what I was trying to flick at in that piece, that for me, this breathing thing is so much about interconnectedness. And I breathe in what you breathe out. I mean, everything we are now learning about COVID is that it's these aerosolized particles that are really what, you know, where the action is much more so than touching things. And I guess for me, the idea of I am an island, I stand alone, I want my face to be seen, I refuse to cover up, it's so defiant of everything we know just about the science of this pandemic, but also just what it is to come together as a society, right? Like, you're only as safe as the last person who breathed into your face. And the refusal to wear a mask sort of seems to be magical thinking and hoping that maybe nobody sneezes on you. But it feels very, very solipsistic and self-involved in a way that's kind of hard to wrap your head around if you believe that we come together, we left the caves, we left like the bonking each other with bats in order to do something beyond just, I want the world to see my face.
Right. No, you put that so beautifully. And, you know, there's, of course, another way that it flips over into the unrest of this summer, and that is that demonstrators were so frequently assailed with things that inhibited their breathing, or, I mean, that's actually kind of a euphemism, and that we wound up having these bizarre conversation about what's tear gas. Like, it's not tear gas if it doesn't say Acme tear gas on the side of the canister. Both William Barr and members of the Trump administration were trying to claim that despite the fact that people are gasping and their eyes are watering and they're vomiting, that they haven't been tear gassed. You know, you go back to the poetry of Wilfred Owen from World War I, there's a way in which that idea of gassing people, once again, in this very visceral way, gets at the very nature of life.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I was listening to your conversation with your last guest, and I've also really fallen hard into my yoga practice in the last few months, Colin, because of all the things you talked about. And I guess I should confess too that I get pneumonia almost once a year and have terrible asthma. So I'm one of those people who's really vulnerable to, you know, cities that are burning and to tear gas and to this disease. And so I sort of come at it from a posture of, I wish I could stride around and say that I am immune to everything, but it's just not physiologically the case for me. And so then I do become really, really acutely attuned to the kinds of things that you're describing. And when you have park police or unmarked badged guards going around spraying pepper spray into crowds and saying, oh, this is an organic agent, it's not a chemical tear gas, therefore it's okay that there are people in this park, including journalists, but peaceful protesters who can't breathe. It does feel like the metaphor is really punching you in the neck. I mean, it's hard to miss that these internecine legal conversations about whether or not it was in fact tear gas is beside the point if there are people who legitimately can't breathe.
Right. I think we eventually established that tear gas is tear gas. I mean, it's not like a really specific thing. It's the thing that makes you have a tear gas. It's the symptom, not the particular thing that gets delivered. And yeah, I mean, just to toggle back and forth a little bit, I mean, with COVID-19, one of the other struggles was, were people appropriately protected when they went into these frontline situations? Did they have the respirators? Did they have the appropriate protective equipment so that their own breathing apparatus, even as they, you know, were delivering care to other people severely respiratorily compromised, or delivering goods and merchandise and needed stuff to people, and unneeded stuff probably too, to people, were they adequately protected? And once again, that came down really once again to the linings of our lungs.
Yeah, and it's funny. What you just mentioned reminds me of the fact that one of the things I wrote in that piece about being able to breathe was that it's breathlessness is about scarcity, right? It's about this thing that you go through, you move through life convinced you will always have the next breath. And it's not like other ailments in that I think we take for granted, all of us, that we are always going to be able to breathe. And in some ways for me, it really dovetailed not just with, you know, the insanity of not being able to get PPE for frontline workers, the doctors and nurses, you know, people stocking shelves, people working in old folks' homes. But that idea of scarcity, that the richest country in the world didn't have enough and couldn't procure enough, and that the giving out of that equipment became this politicized, capitalistic, weird, you know, who's friends with Jared Kushner race to the bottom. And I think for me, I guess I also thought this issue of not being able to breathe in this moment also just seems to flow from ignoring climate change, ignoring.
Yes. And Dahlia, you know, I would love to go into that. I would love to go into that. Unfortunately, I'm literally out of time. I hate to,
okay.
I hate to interrupt Dahlia Lithwick. We're not out of breath, but we are out of time. Thank you very much for listening today. You're going to be asked to support this show and the station. Please, please answer the bell.
You are listening to the Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio, and hopefully as you're listening, and we know you enjoy Colin McEnroe, who doesn't? The guy and his staff, great staff. Kat Pastor's a person that's helping out on the show. She's with me right now, but you also have Jonathan McNichol as well on that, and we're talking about Betsy Kaplan, Josh Nalea. This is some great star power that can help turn such great stories into really thought-provoking conversation in an hour, whether it be from, you know, various topics, whether we're talking about sports or we're talking about maybe some of the more seasoned minds on politics. And really, how incredible was it that not only were having Colin McEnroe come to you during a pandemic when he's not necessarily going to be in public right now, as we got to protect the great Colin McEnroe and hopefully he doesn't get sick from COVID-19. But also you have a situation where they did another damn impeachment show, that podcast, in a second season because we had two impeachments, but they were able to pull it off during a pandemic. Support that show by calling 1-800-584-2788. Support Colin McEnroe. Support Kat Pastor. Kat, how are you today?
I'm doing good. And that's right. Another damn impeachment show. The amount of work that went into that show, it was incredible to watch everyone pull that together and using all of their strengths to really make something great again, because it was technically the second season of that show. So if that's the kind of thing that you support, 1-800-584-2788 if you're a phone person. But if you're not, WMPR.org/donate. You can become a monthly sustaining donator, which means that it's just taken out of your checking account, set it and forget it. You can change the amount at any time, but you don't really have to think about it that much. Or a one-time donator, and you can check out all the great thank you gifts that we have for you. But as I said before, just like the amount of work that goes into every single thing that happens at this station, at this broadcasting company, is wild. And I can promise the listeners one thing, and that's when they show their pledge of support or donate, their money is going so far. Like, just the amount of expansion and new shows that have happened in the past year that I've been here is crazy. So that is one thing that I feel good about whenever we do these pledges, is that I know that we're asking people for, money that's well spent, and something that we're giving back to them in a sense in terms of content and more ways to get them the news and the content that they need. So again, that's 1-800-584-2788, or you can go online to wmpr.org/donate. And we thank you so much for your support.